This teaching, given by Mike Sia, is entitled, Everything is Relative. It is intended as an aid to effective use of Mike's evangelistic tracks. This teaching covers the background to the track, Everything is Relative. These tracks and a catalog of other tapes and tracks are available from Pilgrim Tapes, Box 296, Sunland, California, 91040.
In this session, we're going to be using the track, Everything is Relative. So if you'd like to get the track out, Everything is Relative, we're going to be looking at the subject of humanism and how it relates to relativism, because one of the most common ideas that you meet on the street today is the idea that everything is relative, and we want to look at where that kind of thinking comes from. Now, in one of our other sessions, we talked about naturalism, and the way that man looks at the universe today, in most cases in our society, is that he's a naturalist. He says that things are in a completely closed system. Matter and energy is a completely closed system, and there's no possibility of intervention from the outside by any supernatural, because there isn't a supernatural. There isn't anything like God or any other kind of supernatural thing. The highest thing to appeal to is matter and energy. And then out of that, you automatically have, logically, and it would have to be chronologically, you will have evolution. Because if matter and energy is the highest thing that there is the highest thing that you can appeal to, then matter and energy and chance are the only things that could have produced life on the earth. And so you have evolution automatically follows from the idea of naturalism, because there is no God and there's no supernatural intervention. Then matter and energy, by chance, had to bring about all life. Then out of that, you have the idea that man must be the highest of the highest intelligence. There's no other intelligence greater than his, because we know that the animals don't have the intelligence of the human being. And since there isn't any supernatural, you can't appeal to an infinite mind. Therefore, man's finite mind is the highest intelligence that there is. And so out of naturalism, you automatically get evolution, and out of that, you get humanism. And humanism, as the word is used today, means the idea that that man is of the highest significance. He is the highest, has the highest intelligence in the universe. There's nothing greater than that. So practically speaking, it is atheistic, saying that man is basically the center of the universe. The other tenets of humanism are that man is good, and that man can solve all of his own problems with his finite mind alone if he's just given enough time. It seems like the more time you give man, the worse the situation gets. And so he's obviously not proving that. Now, when a man, with his own finite mind, tries to figure out what his meaning is in the universe, there is a certain process that he goes through. And we want to look at that process as to how man, with his finite mind alone, tries to figure out what his meaning or place in the universe is. And that process is called a process of abstraction. A man will try with his mind, whether he does this consciously or subconsciously, he will try with his mind to group things together into categories so that he can have understanding of how those things relate to each other and how he relates to those things and they relate to him. And there's a process that he goes through in his mind to try to find one ultimate category under which he can fit everything in the universe so that he can have understanding of everything in the universe. And we want to look at this process. We're going to start out with cows. Let's say you have a cow. Now, we're going to imagine this is a black and white cow, has black and white spots on it, and we'll give it a bell, has a bell around its neck, and we'll call the cow what?
Gertrude.
Okay, we're going to call the cow Gertrude. whatever. Is that? Yeah. We're going to call the cow Gertrude. Now, the lowest level of abstraction and the highest level of concreteness would be to have Gertrude right here. Okay? Then we would all see the same, basically the same black and white spots, depending on which side of the cow we were on. We would all see the same qualities of the cow, you know, manure on the tail, flies buzzing around, see its breath in the cold air, hear the bell when it moves, and so forth. right? So then that would be the lowest level of abstraction, highest level of concreteness. Now what we're going to do is leave out a lot of the concrete details, and we're going to go up a level, actually up a number of levels, of abstraction. We're going to take out or abstract the concrete details of Gertrude, and we're going to say cow. Now, when we do that, Gertrude fits under the category of cow, but then so do a whole bunch of other cows, namely all the cows in the world or the universe, if there happen to be cows on other planets. All right? Who knows? And so when you say cow, what you've done is you've taken the particular cows in the world and you have put them in a category, and you call that category cow. Whenever we use language, we symbolize actual things, and when we do that, we take out the concrete details of those things, we conceptualize them in the abstract, and we attach a sound or sounds to that concept, like cow, right? What we're doing is attaching a symbol to a whole set of concrete details, because if you included all the details of every cow in the world, you would have millions of details, probably more than you could keep in your mind. So what we do then is we put that into a category and call it cow, right? And yet one of these cows does happen to be Gertrude. Now, then we also can have some other animals, because these are cows. We can have some other animals, which happen to be chickens. And out of those chickens, when we use the word chicken, then we leave the concrete details out, and we go up a number of levels of abstraction to use the word chicken to represent all of the chickens in the world. Now, another thing we can do is, if we've got cows and chicken, let's take another category here. We've got sheep. And we're going to take then those three categories, cows, chicken, and sheep, and we're going to say farm animal. Now what we've done is left, again, a lot of the concrete details out, and by leaving the concrete details out, we include more things, or what in philosophy is called particulars, we include more particulars under that category. Now, we have domesticated animals here, or farm animals, and then you can have wild rabbits. It's hard to have just a few wild rabbits. Okay. You can have wild rabbits, and then you can have another category here that you could call non-moral animals. Should include all the animals in the world. That's domesticated and non-domesticated, okay? Non-moral animals. Then over here, you've got human beings, which are moral animals. Animals having intellect, emotions, and will. Personal animals, okay? So then you can have the category animal. But then you've got things like plants. And you may have other categories down here that you fit together, so, you know, whatever. And then you can have living things. And you've got all these categories, and as you go up the levels, you become more and more abstract, and you include more and more things under those categories. Now, the way we understand in our minds our meaning and place in the universe is we find out where we fit. We go up the levels of abstraction to a common level, a level that is common between ourselves and something else, for instance, Gertrude. And we'll go up the levels of abstraction to a common category. Then we go down the levels of abstraction, and we understand through these categories, we understand what our place in the universe is, how we relate to the other thing, and the other thing relates to us. For instance, as Christians, starting with our ultimate category, we actually can come to one because of revelation, not with our finite minds, but because God has revealed to us that what this ultimate category is. We can say, I relate to a cow in this sense. The cow is a created being. I am a created being. You see? Now, there's going to be there are two basic categories there: uncreated being, God, and created beings, right? Created things or the universe. And then it breaks down from there. Well, I happen to be a created thing that is in the image of God. The cow happens to be a created thing that is not in the image of God, but we both happen to be animals. Okay? We're both nephesh, according to the scripture, a soul or a living thing. And so the Bible puts us in a category along with cows, because I am referred to as nephesh, and so is a cow referred to as nephesh, or soul. Okay? A living thing, biological thing. Now, the cow, however, is not in the image of God, and I am in the image of God, and that helps me understand how I'm different from the cow, that I am created and the cow is created and we're both animals and we have biological life, helps me understand how I'm similar to the cow. And then in reference to our infinite reference point, I'm in the image of God, the cow is not in the image of God, it helps me to understand my place, my significance, my meaning, my purpose, in the scheme of the entire universe. Do you understand what's happening here? What we do is we take our finite points and we compare them to an infinite reference point, and that's how we figure out what the meaning of that point is. That idea is not new to me. Jean-Paul Sartre said that. He said, no finite point has any meaning except with respect to an infinite reference point. And so what people are looking for to give them understanding of the meaning of the universe is the ultimate category at the top of the chain. And that in philosophy is called an infinite universal. That helps you to understand the particulars of the universe, which are the cows and the sheep and the pigs and the people and whatever, the stars, the galaxies, the rocks, the plants. Now, what we're looking for then is an infinite universal to help us understand the meaning of the finite particulars in the universe. The problem with this is that when you start with naturalism and you go through evolution to humanism, man has only his own finite mind to figure out what this infinite universal is. And so, by definition, he cannot do it. Because he has a finite mind, he will not be able to extrapolate or figure out or project. He will not be able to extrapolate an infinite universal. Consequently, he can never really be sure that the universal that he's arrived at with his finite mind really answers the questions of philosophy that he needs to answer. What his meaning and place in the universe is, what the meaning and place of everything is. He's never going to be able to be quite sure if he has found the answer. And so, with his finite mind, man cannot extrapolate an infinite universal. The only way that that could come to us is through revelation from an infinite mind. And from the Christian perspective, that's what we say has happened. That we have had revelation come to us from an infinite mind that tells us what the category is that's at the top of the chain. But we could not have figured it out with our own finite minds any more than any other finite human being could have done it. And so if at some point the human being does not receive revelation from the mind of God, he is sunk philosophically because he's not going to be able to figure out what's going on in the universe with his own finite mind. Are you with me so far? Okay, that's called an infinite universal, and it's the thing at the top of the chain. Now, with the finite mind, a man will usually come to an abstract philosophical concept that's at the top of the chain. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they come out with something concrete. For instance, in evolution, in the doctrine of evolution, it says that the ultimate thing at the top of the chain, the ultimate universal, is matter and energy. That is the thing that's at the top that explains everything else in the universe. But if you reduce everything down to matter and energy, you have to ask, what is the significance of anything? If everything has come about by chance, what is my significance as a human being if I am an accident in the universe? What is the significance of an accident? What is the significance of any of my feelings or aspirations if they're only collusions of electrochemical reactions in my nervous system? And I was talking to a girl one time, and she said, well, she said she was an evolutionist, and she said she was a relativist. And I said, well, does that mean you think that there's really basically no difference between a snail and a man? And she said, the only difference would be that the man's electrochemical reactions in his nervous system were more complex. And I said, and can you assign any significance to greater complexity of an electrochemical reaction? And she said, no. And I said, so then, whether I step on the snail or I shoot you, doesn't make any difference. I'm eliminating electrochemical reactions, or I'm eliminating electrochemical reactions. And she said, yes, that's right. And I said, did you protest the war in Vietnam? I knew she was the kind who would have. I said, did you protest the war in Vietnam? And she didn't have anything to say because she knew she was a hypocrite. She had just said it makes no difference to step on a snail or shoot a human being, and yet she felt very deeply about the war in Vietnam. There was no basis for that whatsoever in her philosophy, so she was a hypocrite. All right? As I said before, at least as a Christian, I get to choose whether or not I'm going to be a hypocrite. Any person following any other philosophy in the world has to be a hypocrite because they cannot live their philosophy. So they will always say one thing with their mouths and live another thing with their lives, so they will always have to be hypocrites by the nature of the situation. At least we as Christians get to choose whether or not we're going to be hypocrites because our philosophy is livable. We actually can live it if we choose to do so. Everybody else, though, has to be a hypocrite. All right. Now then, you're looking for this infinite universal, and if you, with a finite mind, are looking for an infinite universal, by definition, you cannot accomplish that. Because, with your finite mind, you can't figure out something that's infinite. Consequently, the only way you could get out of that is if you have revelation from an infinite mind. Now, when a person does not have an infinite universal to help him understand what's going on in the universe, if he has no universal, the only thing he has to appeal to, see, this universal would be objective to himself. And if the only thing that he has to appeal to is his own finite thoughts, choices, experiences, then truth for him becomes completely subjective. And because it's completely subjective going on inside him, his thoughts, his choices, his feelings, it's not objective, it's not outside of him, because he has no infinite universal to appeal to, an objective universal, then he has only his own subjective experiences, and out of that, his truth will always be relative, because it can differ from person to person. Okay, we'll get to that a little bit more in another session when we talk about the track You Have Your Truth and I Have Mine, which is basically an expression of existentialism. But here, when the truth is subjective and he can only appeal to his own finite mind, then what happens is truth also becomes completely relative because it can differ from person to person. And you can use these kinds of arguments when you're talking with people. I do it all the time talking with people. They'll say, well, you think a certain thing is true and another person will think a certain thing is true, and how do you know then that what you believe is right and what they believe is wrong? And I say, well, I don't appeal to what I personally believe to be true. I believe that truth is based on something objective to all human experience, and that is revelation from the mind of God. It's based on God and what God says, who he is and what he says. It's not based on what I think or I feel. And you have to get down to that eventually, because otherwise people will say, well, you've got your truth, I've got mine, you think this thing's true, I think that thing's true, and so who's to say? Well, actually God is to say. If there is information from an infinite mind, then that would rescue us from the philosophical dilemmas that we face. Now, when you say that truth is completely subjective, then you have to say truth is completely relative. And that works both directions. When you're talking with somebody on the street and the person says truth is relative, they say something that sounds like that or is in that realm. Well, you know, what if you think something's right or wrong, somebody else could think something else is right or wrong and it could be completely different. Okay? Relativity of truth in the realm of morality. And so then you can take it from that and work to the subjective. Okay, then what is your basis for truth if you're saying it can differ from person to person or morality can differ from person to person? Well, it's just what the person happens to feel. And if somebody feels that it's okay to murder you, then it's okay to murder you. See? Then you can try to show them the inconsistency of that and that they will never live in any fashion that's consistent with that. Okay, people understand morality. We'll get to moral relativity in another session. Get to that track. Now, if truth is subjective and truth is completely relative, that's where we get the statements today that there are no absolutes and that everything is relative. Do you have some serious problems here? If truth is relative, and there are really no absolutes, you also then have no categories. categories like dog and non-dog, or book and non-book, that which is book and that which is non-book. You also have no categories if you have no absolutes. If there are no absolutes, how can you tell where you stop and the chair starts? Maybe there really is no difference between the two. Because in order to say you are different from the chair, there actually have to be absolutes. You have to talk in terms of absolutes. I am a human being, it is a chair. I am made in the image of God, it is not. I am personal, it is not a personal thing. You have to talk in absolute terms if you're going to make sense of what's going on in the universe. Okay? Now, what happens then is if you have no absolutes, you have no categories. So you have no dog or dogginess, non-dog or non-dogginess categories. And so how are you going to tell the difference between a dog and what is non-dog when there aren't any categories because there aren't any absolutes? You can see here how psychedelic drugs have a tendency to influence people to accept these kinds of ideas, because with psychedelic drugs, it breaks down the categories in your sense experiences, and you have a tendency to sense things as flowing into each other. And the categories in your mind between one thing and another are broken down, so it experientially reinforces this false concept. Because people go, oh yeah, it's just like what I experienced on a drug trip one time. Okay? So you have no absolutes, you have no categories, and then because of that, you have no opposites. Or, as is commonly called in philosophy, antitheses. Antitheses.
Right?
Is that spelled correctly? Antitheses. Yeah. Antitheses. Okay. A thesis is a concept or an idea. An antithesis is the opposite of that idea. So right, the idea of moral right, is the that's a thesis, and the antithesis of that is evil or bad. You have good and bad. Existence, non-existence. Life, death, that kind of thing. Okay? Knowledge, non-knowledge, or reality, illusion. Those are antitheses. Now, when you have no opposites or no antitheses in your philosophy, it affects all three areas of philosophy very profoundly. And this you'll see this is laid out in the tract, Everything is Relative. This is where I'm just giving you the background of thought behind what I've done in the tract. The three major areas of philosophy, of all philosophy and theology, are metaphysics, having to do with what? Being, existence, okay? Did you say what's real?
Yeah.
See, the problem when you say something like that, rather than being or existence, is that that borders on the realm of epistemology, because the whole realm of reality is really in the realm of epistemology rather than metaphysics. Whether or not something exists and whether or not we can tell if it's real are two different things. So, I mean, not that the person on the street's probably going to make that kind of a distinction because they probably never thought that through, but we should. Because just in case we do happen to run into a philosophy professor on the street, he'll say, well, you're mixing your epistemology and your metaphysics. All right? This is a problem with Francis Schaeffer that a lot of scholars had with Francis Schaeffer, is he consistently mixed up his metaphysics with his epistemology. What was to be known and how it was to be known, he mixed up quite frequently. Okay? Metaphysics is the area of being or existence. Morals is the area of choice, right and wrong, good and evil, having to do with whether or not there actually is good and evil, and then whether or not there are standards by which we can judge that, so forth. And then the area of epistemology, which has to do with knowledge and the verification of knowledge. How does one come to know something, and then how does one verify that that is so? Okay? Now, when you have no absolutes, no categories, no opposites, no antitheses, then you have, in the realm of metaphysics, you have no existence, non-existence, absolutes. So if you don't have a difference between existence and non-existence, then what do you come up with? Well, if you look in the tract, you notice here it says, this is why man comes to philosophical conclusions like, number one, idealism. The idea that things may only exist if some finite mind is experiencing them, so they may not absolutely exist. In the realm of metaphysics, you get idealism. It's actually, the L is only in there for pronunciation. It's actually ideaism. They've put the L in for pronunciation. This is not to be confused with the statement something like, a communist is an idealist. In this case, it's talking about ideaism, saying that things may only exist as ideas in someone's finite mind, and that you can never really be sure that things absolutely objectively exist, because with the finite mind, you cannot perceive that object in the number of ways necessary to be able to conclude its absolute and objective existence, as Immanuel Kant said. Okay? Immanuel Kant made that observation. With the finite mind, you cannot conclude the absolute existence of anything. Therefore, you can only sort of, you try to be sure that it exists on the basis of whether or not some finite mind is experiencing that object at the moment. Consequently, you get philosophers who talk like this. I can't really be sure, because of the finiteness of my mind, I can't really be sure that that half of the universe exists, because I'm not presently experiencing it. See? I can't really be sure that that half of the universe exists. And so you get different philosophers with different ways of relating to reality. Like Bertrand Russell proposed what he called representative realism. He said, the universe presents itself to us as if it were real, but we cannot really conclude that it exists. It just seems to be that way. So he called it representative realism. It represents itself to us as if it were real. But you can't really be sure that it is. Okay? Can't prove that. What a way to live, huh? All right. So we don't know whether or not, and they'll do all kinds of things. Like, there is something under here that I can experience. I can see and touch and so forth. But how do you know that it's real? Is there any way that you can prove that that's real? See? Starting with the finite mind, you can't prove that. And there are great debates that go on in modern philosophy classes and so forth about whether or not the piece of chalk exists after the professor puts it behind the podium or in the podium. And so from the finite perspective, you can't really be sure that it does exist because you've lost your absolutes in the area of existence. There is no real existence, non-existence, so you get relativized existence, that is, things only exist inasmuch as a finite mind experiences them. So the existence of things is relative. It is relative to the experience of human beings. All right? That's one major problem. That's idealism. The second major one is in the realm of morals. And what do we call relativized morality? Situation ethics. Choices are determined to be right or wrong according to the circumstances surrounding the choice. Thus, man makes up his own relative morality since he cannot know if any choices are absolutely right or wrong. And you can see John Fletcher's great confusion in his book, Situation Ethics, where he defines love 9 different ways. It says the ultimate choice that man has to make is to love others, and yet he defines it 9 different ways in the book, some of which are subjective, some of which are objective, and many of which are mutually exclusive of the other definitions. So you can see the great confusion there as to exactly, when you get out into the relative realm, there's very little definition also. So he gives 9 different definitions, and some of them don't even fit with each other. All right. In the realm of morals, we have what's called situation ethics. That is, we determine, as individuals, what is going to be right and wrong. And so morality can vary from person to person. You have relativized morality instead of absolute morality. And in the realm of epistemology, in the realm of knowledge and the verification of knowledge, you have relativized knowledge. And so that means nothing can be absolutely known, and so you always have to be skeptical of everything. And so you get philosophical skepticism in the realm of epistemology. Skepticism says that no one can know anything for sure, since man with his finite mind cannot establish the absolutes necessary for true knowledge. And so when you're dealing with people on the street, you'll find that these three realms are, you'll find them quite consistent. That they'll say that things, well, people make up their own right and wrong. How can we really be sure whether or not things exist? How can you know anything for sure? And so the humanist will consistently ask you questions that start with the words, how do you know? Because they have no absolute knowledge. And so they'll say, how do you know the Bible is the Word of God? How do you know that there is a God? How do you know that Jesus was raised from the dead? How do you know that Christianity is true? Okay? How do you know that there is a spiritual world? They'll ask you all kinds of questions that start that way because they cannot have absolute knowledge. The only problem is that they constantly go around saying, we know, I know, so forth, when they don't have any basis for that. And you'll find very few consistent humanists who constantly say, I think, I believe, I feel, and refuse to say, I know. Most of them will say, I know, and arrogantly assert that they know something when they don't have any basis whatsoever in their philosophy. Now, the question then is, and this is brought up in the tract, since the problem is a limitation of man's intelligence, what's the only thing that's going to rescue us from that dilemma of having no absolutes because we have no infinite universal? The only thing that could rescue us from that is revelation from an infinite mind. That is, not that we figured out an infinite universal, but that God, from his infinite perspective, revealed to us, through his infinite knowledge, revealed to us what the infinite universal is. And it just happens to be God himself. And so the universal at the top of the whole chain is not an abstract philosophical concept, but a person that we can know and be related to. Okay? And so fortunately the answer is yes, as the tract says. God has given us information, and he's given that to us in his word. And this is where, of course, you're going to have to be ready to defend the Bible as the word of God, be able to show other people that the Bible is exactly what it claims to be, a revelation from an infinite mind. What you end up with then is you get, in the realm of metaphysics, now let's take it from the top here and do the chart a little differently. If you start out with the idea of supernaturalism, that is, the universe is open and there is a supernatural element in the universe, then there's the possibility that a mind like the mind of God could exist, and instead of having naturalism, and which leads to evolution to humanism, you have supernaturalism, which leads to the possibility of revelation. Of course, the intermediate step there would be creation instead of evolution. Okay? You have supernaturalism, which leads to creation, which then there's the possibility of revelation from a mind like the mind of God. So rather than having the human mind be the ultimate in intelligence, you have the mind of God is the ultimate in intelligence, and he can give us information that we could not figure out with our own finite minds, like where we came from. That's why the Bible is so important as far as creation is concerned. Nobody was there, right, when things were created except God. And so God revealed to us that things were created and they existed. We'll get to that in a little bit. They existed whether any finite mind experienced them or not, because he was experiencing them from his infinite perspective. So with revelation from an infinite mind, there is the possibility of having an infinite universal in your system because that can be revealed to you from a mind like the mind of God. Consequently, truth is no longer subjective and relative. It is based on something objective to the human being. That is, revelation from the mind of God. So truth then becomes objective, and it can be then absolute. So instead of having no absolutes, you have real absolutes. Instead of having no categories, you have real categories. Instead of having no opposites or antitheses, you have real opposites. Then, in the realm of metaphysics, you have real existence, real non-existence. You have absolute existence or non-existence. And so the things that we sense about the universe, God tells us in his word, are true. We seem to sense that things are really real or they aren't. That something either exists or it does not. Okay, that doesn't mean necessarily that it's material, but that it actually exists rather than sort of being part there and part not. Right? I mean, we might not have physical experience of a radio wave, but we can show that it is there, and it does not sort of partially exist and partially not. It does exist, it just happens to be a different form of material or substance. Okay, or, you know, of course, all kinds of theories as to exactly what radio waves happen to be. But anyway, and light and that kind of stuff. So we, instead of having idealism, what we get then is, through the revelation of God, we can see that there is real existence, real non-existence. And so we have what's called realism rather than idealism. That's the opposite of that. Realism rather than idealism. And how do we know that that's so? Well, God tells us in Genesis chapter 1 that things existed whether any finite mind ever experienced them or not, because God said on the first day he made this, the second day he made this, third day he made this, and God talks about trees and animals and plants and stars and earth and light and all the different things of the creation. And it wasn't until the sixth day that the finite mind of man came along. And so God, from his infinite perspective, tells us things exist whether a finite mind experiences them or not. They absolutely, objectively exist. The tree out there absolutely, objectively exists. How do I know that? Because God, from his infinite perspective, has revealed information to our minds that that thing will exist whether we experience it or not, because he created it to exist that way. Okay? So we're dependent upon revelation from an infinite mind at that point. Okay, the second realm is the realm of morals. In the realm of morals, you have absolute morality. Instead of having situation ethics, you've got absolute morality. You have real right, real wrong. And the only way, of course, we can know that absolutely is through the infinite understanding of God. And so God has revealed to us absolutes in the realm of morality, which are generally related to as the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue. He gives us the statements of what is absolutely right and absolutely wrong for human beings to do. And those particular activities that are not covered in the Scripture, they're not covered absolutely. This is absolutely right, that is absolutely wrong, are covered by absolute principles of conscience, so that each individual can determine what is absolutely right or wrong for him to do in a circumstance, even though he can't determine that for anybody else. He can still determine it for himself. And so God has not left any of the areas of human activity uncovered by absolutes. Do you understand? Everything's covered. It's either this is absolutely right, it's absolutely wrong, or for you as an individual, it will be absolutely right or wrong according to the principles of conscience. Right? But in the area of the principles of conscience, you can't determine for anybody else what's right and wrong in that area. You can only determine that for yourself. But then the next person can take those same principles and determine for himself or herself whether or not that activity is right or wrong for that person. See, but it's still absolute. Right? So you have absolute morality even in the realm of where activity can be different from person to person. Like one person may feel, I can go to movies. Another person may feel, I cannot go to movies. And yet they're both following the same absolute principles. Okay? So it's still absolute morality, even though the end result may differ from person to person. You got that?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. And if you want more teaching on that, you can get my tapes on principles of conscience, where I take all the principles of conscience from the New Testament, put them in one lecture. All right? Now, that's the area of morality. And in the area of epistemology, we can have true knowledge, because knowledge is no longer based on what I think or I feel as a relative thing between myself and somebody else. It's based on what God has said. And so where God has spoken about reality, I can say, I know that this is so. But only in the realms where God has absolutely spoken. And so when a person says to me, well, how do you know? I usually say, on the basis of my presupposition. They usually look at me like, what does that mean? You know, because they haven't usually thought it through that far. And say, well, I know on the basis of my presupposition. How would you know anything? And what's the presupposition you're working on to establish knowledge? See, my presupposition is that there's a supernatural behind the universe. And that's something that you either presuppose or you don't. Right? So a lot of people presuppose that there isn't. Well, there isn't really any empirical way to prove or not prove a presupposition. Okay? There is evidence that we can offer that perhaps the Scripture is what it calls itself, a revelation from an infinite mind, and then that impinges upon the whole area of presuppositions. But to directly try to prove a presupposition, apart from an historical approach through something like a revelation from the mind of God, like the Bible, you can't do it. It's just, you know, you sort of assume that either there is a God or there isn't one. You start with that idea or you don't start with it. Well, I start with it. Okay, I asked a zoologist one time, a Christian zoologist, well, what do you think about evolution? And she said, evolution is a theory that you either presuppose or you do not before you investigate the facts. And she said, I do not presuppose it. She said, therefore, the facts don't seem to bear it out. Okay. So then I presuppose that there's the possibility of something like revelation from a mind like the mind of God, and I look for that. The person who's presupposing that there isn't any possibility like that can't come up with revelation from an infinite mind, and so is stuck with the problems of his own finite mind. So towards the end of the tract, you see here, we have absolute existence, or what is called realism, absolute morality, it's called the Ten Commandments, and absolute knowledge. When God has spoken concerning any particular unit of knowledge, we can know for sure that this is true because God speaks from an infinite perspective. Thus, through God's word, the Bible, we can be free from the relativistic thought that plagues our generation. And then I go on in the tract to talk about how not only does the Bible free us from the relativism, but it also shows us how to have a relationship with God. And you always have to get on to that point. The whole point when you're witnessing to someone is always get back to the subject of Jesus Christ. What are you going to do with Jesus Christ? And so you do your pre-evangelism, but you must remember to always get back to being an evangelist, because apologetics only applies when somebody asks a question. When somebody says, how do you know the Bible is the Word of God? You take off your preacher's hat, you put on your apologist's hat, and you start answering questions. Then, when you've answered the question, you take off your apologist's hat, you put your preacher's hat back on, and you go on preaching the gospel. See? So it says, be ready to give an answer to every man that asks a reason for the hope that is within you, yet with gentleness and reverence. But when you've finished answering the question, you don't go on answering questions. That's not what we're called to do. Okay? We're to be ready to answer questions, but that's not what Jesus said. He didn't say, go out and answer questions. He said, go out and preach the gospel. And so we put the apologist's hat on for as long as is necessary to answer the question. And then when the person has a good answer, then you take the apologist's hat off, you put the preacher's hat back on, and you go on preaching the gospel to the person. So you say, see, therefore we can know from the Bible that certain things are absolute. Then now let's get down to the whole realm of where you live. There is absolute morality. You have broken the law of God. Therefore, you've rebelled against God. You deserve to be punished. You've been separated from God. But God provided a way that you can come back to Him. Okay? So we eventually have to get down to the essential points of the gospel after we've answered the questions that people have intellectually.